The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. This program will take you behind the scenes and deepen your understanding about the patterns and perspectives of leadership today. Now, here's your host, John Schmidt.
Well, hello. Welcome, everyone, again to this week's edition of Zoomed Leadership. I am your host, of course, John Schmidt. And again today, as every week, I will be taking us out to the big picture, into the up close and personal, and toward a world of desirable futures, those rich, of course, with the essence of constant renewal. Well, it is wonderful to be back here in our home studio on the Bay. It is actually very great to be back after several weeks of travel and broadcasting on the road. Always nice to be grounded in the space where Zoomed flourishes most here. And I think it's this grounding today that offers a platform for emphasis. And today I will say right off, it's on the practical, it is on the tangible, it is focused on a breakthrough alternative to one of our major challenges on the planet, that of personal transport and energy. My guest today is the founder and entrepreneur par excellence behind River Simple, which is a company simultaneously bringing to the world new high fuel efficiency cars to the tune of up to 300 miles per gallon equivalent, and all of that including application of composite materials and a rethinking of the energy equation, but doing all of that while establishing a very innovative business model that offers a whole view, what we often talk about here on Zoomed as a whole systems approach, and doing so here, including structure, governance, and integration across major streams of interaction with society. To me, this model is one of the freshest approaches on the scene today. I look forward to talking about it. And as regular listeners, you know, we often frame the coming era of extraordinary change here on Zoomed as a soup pot mix of breakdowns, surprises, and breakthroughs. Today with Hugo, with our focus on River Simple, we will be exploring what I think is a great example of a tangible breakthrough that underpins our future. River Simple is going to be building cars that systematically eliminate impacts and damage to the environment. And I think you will find, and actually really embrace Hugo. I think he offers a great story. He's a British entrepreneur engineer who for many years designed racing cars before heightened awareness of the environment. That all got the best of him, and he subsequently lived through an MBA, seeing the confining current paradigms, and all of that extended his pathway and that journey from there into hydrogen fuel technology and ultimately to River Simple. So as we get started, you can access River Simple at riversimple.com, RIVERSIMPLE.com. There you can see the pilot vehicle we will be talking about. And of course, that is only part of the conversation. Product is only part of the conversation in a whole view like Hugo's taken, bringing to the table. But Hugo, welcome. Great, actually, to have you on Zoomed.
Hello, John. I'm glad to be here. Thank you very much.
Well, yeah, pleasure. A pleasure when we have entrepreneurs like you that are thinking the larger view as we can. But Hugo, start us off maybe with the personal side. Car racing and design, and as I've talked with you, I think it's an intriguing pathway that led to River Simple. Maybe they can use that personal side as an orientation to you and the company.
Right. Well, I suppose it's worth pointing out that I was actually interested in the environment and ecology before I got into motorsport. Actually, I really became passionate about motor racing when I was about 15, and I already had a great interest in understanding ecology. I felt that motorsport as my sort of career developed, that motorsport is actually the quickest and cheapest way of improving the energy efficiency of vehicles, and if we're and that is clearly an absolute primary concern. But I did reach the point where I felt actually we needed to get rid of the combustion engine altogether and move on to something else. So developing the combustion engine and prolonging its tenure was really hardly defensible any longer. And I got out not knowing what on earth I was going to do, but I knew it was going to be nothing to do with cars. And then I found out all about fuel cells. Because I suppose I'd been thinking that batteries, better batteries, were the only way forward, and that's bigger companies and big budgets and basic science, which is not my world at all. And I realise with fuel cells that the breakthroughs really are to come using existing technologies, good enough, but by systems integration, and that's what motorsport is really good at.
Well, it is, and Hugo, when we've talked about it, I was really struck by the sense of design and your orientation to design, and then how that really dovetailed with the larger picture of that. Maybe a little experience about the design side. I think it's always curious, those that are in even something that has that exciting feature like auto racing to it. And I mean, what is the sense of design and the integration as you're talking about and even exploring that?
Well, motorsport allows you far fewer constraints than in the mainstream auto sector, and that does enable you to think at a bigger picture level. So it comes quite naturally for me to consider the whole system rather than elements of the system, which is the way you're forced into with in the mainstream auto sector, because cars have now become such an incredibly mature technology that the only way to improve them is to break it up into a large number of small teams who actually each optimize one element of the system. And that produces enormous barriers to actually implementing any sort of cross-platform synergies. But you may also be referring to, of course, the design of the whole system and the value network that delivers transport to us. And I think of that as every bit as much design as the actual vehicle. And that's a sort of a level above the actual product, that's the processes and systems. And it could even argue that the design of the corporate structure, which we're deeply involved in as well, is a level above that even. I only started thinking about that when I was thinking about where you raise your money from, and money always has rights and responsibilities attached. So you've got to be very clear that you understand what it is you're trying to achieve and make sure the corporate structure is going to allow you to do what you want when you have got the money.
Well, Hugo, it's helpful to hear how the sort of the ground bed of the whole view for you and the context of the racing. And can you say in our opening segment here sort of an introductory sense about how where that led and to the nature of looking at the possibilities of River Simple and the technology and so forth and the business model and all the larger connections? Maybe you can introduce to our listeners some of the sense of the company.
Yes. Well, I mean, I wasn't expecting to get back into cars. And I had the great good fortune in 97 of spending a week with Paul Hawken, who many of your listeners probably have heard about, and we don't hear nearly as much about over here in the UK. And he told me about the work of Amory Lovins and the Rocky Mountain Institute. And that really got me going and thinking about what was possible by really designing a car for a fuel cell rather than putting fuel cells into cars designed for combustion engines. But it didn't take me very long to realize that actually the principal barriers that we face aren't actually technical. The means are available. We need the will, though, to implement them. And this is true generally of the bulk of our problems, I think, today. And so I went and did my MBA and did a major a commercial feasibility study on bringing the cars to market. And that's when I got deeply embedded in the people, politics, business issues, which, as I say, I think are far more difficult to tackle. And then I went from there. Only after my MBA did I really start considering the corporate structure and governance. But by that stage, I'd evolved a systems view of the value network and the way in which we wanted to deliver the transport service. And this involved a different approach to intellectual property, a different approach to the customer relationship, different approach to the supply chain relationship, a different manufacturing strategy, and all these things. And by that stage started hearing people saying, well, why didn't you just build the car and sell it in the conventional way that everybody else does and worry about these fancy ideas later? Mm-hmm. But the point I'd reached was actually that if you tried to do that, you would demonstrably fail, because the business model and the value network that has evolved around the car industry is very highly geared and perfectly tuned to the products that come out of the auto industry. So almost by definition, if you come up with a fundamentally different product, it is highly unlikely that the business model and value network is going to be appropriate. If you're prepared to change multiple things simultaneously, a whole lot of barriers disappear. And actually, this contemporary attitude that the prudent way to improve things is to change one thing at a time, that's fine if you're optimizing things. But if you're looking for a real step change, making one change at a time creates a huge number of risks and barriers. If you're prepared to change things, multiple things simultaneously, an awful lot of things become practical, possible, and downright more exciting and bigger step forward than anything you could ever achieve in increments. I mean, it's the old quote from Lloyd George, you can't cross a chasm in two leaps. And I think this is abundantly true. People find it very difficult. They find it possible to understand at a vehicle level why you need to change the whole vehicle to harness fuel cells. Mm-hmm. And it's the same argument. You've got to change lots of things simultaneously to make it possible. But people find it very difficult to translate that, take that analogy and look at business models in the same way. It's considered that by many still that we are taking on far too many challenges simultaneously. We believe that actually we are dramatically reducing barriers.
But I really like what you're saying, Hugo, in that the means are available, but you can't put together this means and the new thinking about the product side without thinking about the whole and without thinking about the streams and the value chain and the structures and the yeah. whole system that's really at operating surrounding it. So you've got to look at the organizational perspective, and I think that's a rich one, even as a model for this view, but for other elements of society. I think you're really kicking that off well here as we're kicking into it. And I think that's a beautiful way to even frame and to begin the orientation to the product and to the means that are available. And I know we're about to get into another segment, but what else? Well, let's just save that then. I can hear it in terms of the music in the background starting to build, Hugo. I don't want to get it started, but I think it'd be wonderful within this context. We'll come back to understanding more about the model. But let's go in the next segment, talk about the designs, talk about the technologies, talk about that positive impact and vision, and then we'll frame out the model a little bit more and how it holds it. Let's take a break. Come back in a few minutes here, folks, on Monday with Zoomed. Shortly come back. Thanks.
When it comes to business,
you'll find the experts here.
Voice America Business Network. The world is in flux, primed for a great transition, possibly an epical one. How does it impact you? Does it reshape the questions you ask? The way you view leadership? Today's complexities and challenges call for new realms of leadership. The world needs resilience and adaptability, new levels of innovation and brilliance. At Avastone Consulting, we know that our times call for shifts of mind. How do we cultivate real shifts of mind in our leaders? Not through conventional development, which focuses on gaining skills and knowledge within an established worldview. Shifts of mind truly expand the worldview itself, enlarge the capacity to see through new eyes, and transform interpretations of reality and the actions that accompany them. Those who embrace shifts of mind are the kind of leaders that Avastone helps to build. Change the way you pursue the future. Call Avastone Consulting at 1-678-461-8880. That's 1-678-461-8880. Or visit avastoneconsulting.com. Avastone Consulting, your source for leadership development, working with complex organizations toward evolutionary shifts of mind. There's a course offered on Seventh Wave Network that you never saw offered in college. One that provides information on how to transform ancient wisdom teachings into everyday life. You'll learn how to create from your spirit and explore the world with all of your senses. Participation is encouraged. Enroll in Spirituality 101, the course you can't afford to miss, with your host, Reverend Norma. Class is in session every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, 12 noon Pacific Time, in your favorite classroom, Seventh Wave Network.
It's all Arizona, all over the world. If you're a local Arizona high school sports fan, or if you're a transplanted fan somewhere else in the world, have we got a show for you. The first internet sports radio talk show focusing solely on high school sports is The Coach's Corner with Scott Lovely. Tune in to talk about your favorite teams, players, or coaches. It's 100% Arizona high school sports coverage and a little bit more. Tune in Mondays at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern, to the Voice America Sports Channel.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Listening to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, welcome back. We are here today with our guest, Hugo Spowers. River Simple, our focus. We are talking about a whole view, a whole system, breakthrough thinking about that, that affords the opportunity for a new car and new business model together. Hugo, I pointed to us to this segment. Maybe we can help our listeners get a sense of the technology, the product, what you're actually manufacturing here, and what's different about what's really being built in the world.
Yes, sure, John. I think it's now become widely accepted in the auto industry, in most of the major companies, that hydrogen fuel cell technology is the optimal answer in the future. There's nothing that can come close to a hydrogen fuel cell car for long-range vehicles in terms of energy efficiency and cleanliness. The trouble is that fuel cell technology is relatively immature. It had a big spate of progress driven by NASA in the Apollo and series, and then the shuttles, and it got fuel cells to the point where they could be considered for cars. But nonetheless, they simply do not even approach the power density of combustion engines, and they're fantastically expensive. And so the auto industry has been building cars by putting a fuel cell into the technology and fundamental architecture of cars that has developed over a long period of time. And I want to stress that I think what they're doing is absolutely brilliant. I mean, it's technologically fantastically sophisticated. And I also understand why they have to find an incremental path forwards, because they have hugely developed production and distribution systems, and they have to be able to use those to build the next generation of vehicles. The problem is that it means that these barriers are very, very large indeed, and it is very difficult to get 85 or 100 kilowatts out of a fuel cell that will fit into the engine bay of a car. So,
And why is that, Hugo? Is it this was a size issue?
It is a size and a weight issue. It's a fuel cell operates really. It's a fuel cell is really the reverse of electrolysis. We're all familiar with school experiments of putting water in a beaker and passing electricity through it, and off comes hydrogen and oxygen. A fuel cell is exactly the reverse. You put in the hydrogen and oxygen, and out comes the electricity and water. Trouble is, it's much more difficult to make the reaction go that way than the electrolysis way. And you simply cannot get sufficient surface area to get enough of this reaction going to create enough electricity from a unit that's small enough to fit in an engine bay. And that's why the fuel cells have been developed have become so fantastically sophisticated, really brilliant bits of engineering, but they are a long way from commercial viability. The difference about our car is that in a conventional car, you have a linear powertrain. The engine provides power, goes through a gearbox, and drives the wheels. When you brake, all the energy is released as heat into the atmosphere. In our car, we have four electric motors in the four wheels, and you have a fuel cell that generates electricity, and they go to the four wheels. But you also have a bank of ultracapacitors, which are devices that store static electricity. So those electric motors in the wheels also become the brakes. And when you slow down, you recapture a lot of the kinetic energy, and you feed it into the ultracapacitors. Mm-hmm. These ultracapacitors can take 1,000 amps. Unlike a battery, they can absorb charge very quickly and discharge it very quickly. So when you accelerate, 80% of the power comes from these ultracapacitors, which means that the fuel cell only needs to provide 20% of the power. And if you only need a fifth of the power, it makes it less easier.
You're really shifting the percentage here, that the power fuel cell is doing something different than that 80% of the power you're describing in a traditional vehicle, then you're contrasting the traditional vehicle here. Maybe
yes.
You can then say that a little bit more, because I think that's a big point here to get.
Yes. All these, the four electric motors and the fuel cell and the ultracapacitors are all connected to each other. We call this a network electric vehicle because energy can flow in either direction except back into the fuel cell. The point of it is that the fuel cell is only responsible for a very small amount of power. It's sized just to give enough power for when you're cruising at your maximum cruise speed. And in a conventional car, you're only using about 15% of your peak power when you're cruising on a freeway. In our case, we only need the fuel cell to provide that 15% or 20% of power, which means that you can have a much smaller, less powerful fuel cell whilst you still have the same acceleration in the car. And that means that the fuel cell is massively more commercially viable. The fuel cell in our car, if we wanted a few thousand of them, would cost somewhere between $3,000 and $5,000 per unit. Whereas the fuel cell in the Honda Clarity that has got Honda built a run of 200 of them, each fuel cell in that vehicle has cost $900,000. Clearly that's a long way from viability.
Wow. And so the difference, we're talking about a big difference in the paradigm here, in that the energy you're providing is for the cruising side of it as opposed to the power generation side of it.
Absolutely. When you're accelerating, you use the ultracapacitors. And if you want better acceleration, it's simply a matter of how you use those ultracapacitors. You don't need a bigger fuel cell. If you want better acceleration in a conventional car, you need more power, and then you have a higher top speed, whether you like it or not. We can actually control our top speed and our acceleration and specify exactly what we want, and they are independent variables. And if we want a higher top speed or better acceleration, you will have slightly worse fuel economy. And that is that triumvirate of variables is the system that we're trying to optimize.
And then with this, you're using a lighter vehicle then as well, are you not?
Yes, we have a much lighter vehicle made of composite materials, and the advantage of that is that you can have a smaller fuel cell. Again, you can have smaller electric motors and fewer ultracapacitors, so that means that all these components come down in weight. And the weight of the structure is largely governed by the heavy bits you have to hang on to in accidents. So, again, the structure can become lighter. All these iterative mass decompounding loops save weight and increase efficiency all as you go round and round this virtuous circle spiraling downwards in weight, then it means you need narrower tires while still having the same grip because the vehicle's lighter. And if you have narrower tires, you simply don't need power-assisted systems for steering and braking. So those are further step changes in weight and efficiency. And it's this decompounding approach that we think is terribly important, and that connected, that coupled with the fuel cell being sized for cruise only, decoupling the cruise and acceleration, those two principles unlock huge advantages and mean that the existing fuel cell technology is good enough here and now to build a commercially viable car.
Good enough here and now, and I was introducing some sense about the equivalent miles per gallon. What would it actually then be?
Well, actually, the 300 mpg is the figure that we quote here using imperial gallons. That works out at about 240 mpg in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
If we were talking, this is a car the size of the Smart, two-seater car for local use and urban use and things like that. If we wanted a five-seat family car that would be cruising on freeways, we believe that it'll be doing somewhere between 180 and 200 miles per gallon.
Still 180 to 200.
Energy equivalent.
Wow.
Yes. And that that translates to, in our existing car, to a CO2 emission figure. I don't know what metrics you use in the States, but in Europe we talk about grams per kilometer and 31 grams of CO2 per kilometer, which is less than a third of the lowest emitting car on the market today. And that's assuming that the hydrogen comes from natural gas, which is where most of it comes from at the moment, though obviously ultimately we want to move away from hydrogen from natural gas and get it from renewable sources.
And so that's where you start to really say and start to look at the net impact of this from an environmental standpoint and from the energy standpoint. It's a combined set of elements here that make this very compelling, Hugo.
Yes. Yes, and the one of the key points about hydrogen is that we must think of it as an alternative to an equivalent to electricity. It is not a primary fuel, so it shouldn't be compared with petrol. Hydrogen can come from any energy source, but you can't dig it out of the ground or pluck it off trees. So it is very similar to electricity from that point of view. But if we move to hydrogen vehicles, it means we can develop the vehicle technology and the refueling infrastructure using hydrogen from fossil fuel sources initially, but we can move incrementally from completely brown hydrogen, as I call it, to green hydrogen at any rate we like, in small increments, without the customer knowing anything about it and without having to invest any more in the technology or the infrastructure. And that completely decouples the transport sector from oil, which is a huge step forwards. It also, of course, if you really think it through, has big geopolitical consequences in that renewable sources anywhere around the world can be used to make hydrogen. Every region in the world has a different mix of available renewable sources, and they can still use whatever their local sources are and yet collaborate with the rest of the world on global technology standards in developing the vehicles. So, it, and also the other thing, of course, is that renewable sources are generally much more evenly distributed around the world than oil is.
Yeah, and I hear the music coming up in the background, Hugo, and I know my listeners are going to be thinking to themselves, interesting, and how much does it cost? Let's come back and get that on the next segment as we link that in, get a sense of that, put that in the larger picture of the business model, how that whole flow of expenditures really comes together. But come back in a minute here, folks. We continue today with Hugo, with River Simple, with a picture, a larger view, a paradigm-breaking shift. It is a breakthrough for sure. Come on back in a minute. Thanks.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network. The world is in flux, primed for a great transition, possibly an epical one. How does it impact you? Does it reshape the questions you ask? The way you view leadership? Today's complexities and challenges call for new realms of leadership. The world needs resilience and adaptability, new levels of innovation and brilliance. At Avastone Consulting, we know that our times call for shifts of mind. How do we cultivate real shifts of mind in our leaders? Not through conventional development, which focuses on gaining skills and knowledge within an established worldview. Shifts of mind truly expand the worldview itself, enlarge the capacity to see through new eyes, and transform interpretations of reality and the actions that accompany them. Those who embrace shifts of mind are the kind of leaders that Avastone helps to build. Change the way you pursue the future. Call Avastone Consulting at 1-678-461-8888. That's 1-678-461-8880. Or visit avastoneconsulting.com. Avastone Consulting, your source for leadership development, working with complex organizations toward evolutionary shifts of mind.
It's football, pop culture, and everything in between. Get ready for The Game Plan with Anthony Herron, a.k.a. Big Ant. Anthony has a background in college and professional football and brings the player, coach, and broadcaster perspective to this weekly roundup of the top sports news and events. Big Ant wants to hear from you, too. Tune in to The Game Plan with Anthony Herron every Tuesday afternoon at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, 2 p.m. Pacific. Time on the Voice America Sports Channel. It's game time.
These days, everyone is looking for information on staying young, healthy, and fit. The Voice America Health and Wellness Network is here to help you on your quest to better health and a better you. We talk about everything from diet, fitness, and aging to substance abuse, personal growth, mental health, and much more. Learn from our experts who cover health and wellness from traditional and holistic perspectives. Tune in to the Voice America Health and Wellness Network. Healthy living starts here.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, we're back. Continuing our conversation with Hugo Spowers. We're talking River Simple. We are talking about new view, larger picture, new car, new business model. Hugo, I left the last segment. I know our listeners are probably simmering out there to know something about, so how much does this cost? How does that work? But maybe this is a stream for us to sort of swim into relative to the business model itself. But get us kicked off here. How does this actually work? What are the costs involved? How does it play out? How is it economically attractive?
Right. Well, I must first of all point out that we're not selling the cars. We are selling a service. We're selling transport services. So it's much like leasing taking out a mobile phone contract. You'll pay a fixed price element per month with a small variable piece per mile. So it'll probably be in the region of $300, $350 a month, and then about 10 cents a mile. And we think that's actually probably about the same as the total cost of ownership of a smart today. It's certainly a perfectly competitive price. The reason, though, that we want to sell the service rather than the product is because we're trying to align the interests of the customer and the manufacturer. If you sell cars, to be perfectly honest, you make more money by selling more cars. And it sounds a bit confrontational, but the underlying drivers behind that are that you make more money by the car being as unreliable and high maintenance as possible, mm-hmm. the customer keeping it as short a time as possible, the vehicle having as short a life as possible, etc. These are the opposite of what the customer wants. And obviously, you're competing against other manufacturers, so you can't have a horrendously unreliable car. But they all have the same drivers, so there's no absolute driver for absolute excellence to improve the vehicle's life or the fuel efficiency or anything. If you have a sale of service model, and that's driven right the way through the business in every aspect of how we do business, right through to the clean sheet of paper of the car, you will design a fundamentally different car. And that is because we're rewarded for the car being as cheap as possible, as reliable and low maintenance as possible, because we are maintaining it. You to keep it as long as possible, but we don't mind when you get bored of it and you want a new one, you give it back to us. And we want the car then to have as long a life as possible, because we want to lease it into what is traditionally the second-hand market. And that's actually a bigger market than the first-hand market. So we, by and large, want to have the vehicle lasting as long as possible and be as energy efficient as possible, because the mileage charge, the 10 cents per mile, includes your fuel cost. When you fill up with hydrogen, you'll do so with a smart card, and the bill comes to us, not to you. So it means that as the vehicle goes through its life, we have an interest in upgrading it constantly to improve the energy efficiency, because the less fuel it uses, the more money we make. All these
in other words, just to stop this for a minute, in terms of the cost that you have there, the customer is not actually then going and paying a separate fuel cost. This is one cost bundled price that you're talking about, a bundled fee for sale for services.
It is a single transaction, and that includes insurance, and it includes road tax and all the servicing costs and all the fuel costs. And we also think it actually will be a much more convenient way to own a car than the conventional way, which actually involves multiple transactions and is quite a lot of hassle, to be honest. And you think of the number of services that have changed so much in the last 20 years as to how they're delivered, and the way in which the ownership of cars is structured hasn't changed at all in the last 80 years. So we think it's a substantial step forwards. But it aligns the interests of the manufacturer and the customer. It also rewards the minimization of resource consumption. If you sell cars, you're rewarded for the resource maximization of resources. And, of course, policymakers have now wised up to the fact that we, in economic terms, have got to start wringing the maximum possible utility out of every unit of resource we use.
Mm-hmm.
So what hope have we got of achieving a sustainable industrial society if we're rewarding the precise opposite of that? It means that you have to have a damage limitation exercise of regulation to try and contain the problem. But we're still carrying on rewarding the opposite of what we're trying to achieve. And I think that this is a profound step forward that is necessary for us to take if we have any hope for a sustainable industrial society. And it applies far beyond cars.
It does. So that's really supporting a shift in the economic system. We've talked some on Zoom about some of that shift as well. But just back from a practical standpoint for a moment on this, what's the useful life and how of the River Simple car, the vehicle, the pilot you have, and how does that contrast in terms of useful life to what we're experiencing with the paradigm we're living with now?
Well, we think that the technology will produce cars that are suitable for a 20-year economic life. All our financial modelling has been based on 15 years, whereas in the UK the average vehicle life is about 13 years. So 15 years is not too much. The difference, though, is that all 15 years of spend by customers pass through us, the manufacturer. At the moment, the auto industry won't lease a car for more than 4 years, and they have to make their money from those 4 years of spend. We've got 15 years of spend from which we make our profit. And so we can have a car that may cost us more to make, take a higher margin, it can still be cheaper for the customer. Now, that is a huge competitive advantage and allows us to pursue this tack unilaterally. The unique thing about that is that most strategies or innovations that are going to reduce environmental impact represent a cost on the bottom line. And it'll never happen until there's a government mandate and a level playing field. And that's not true in this instance. We can do this unilaterally, and we think it's a huge source of competitive advantage. And you've got to remember also that in times of economic crisis, when there's a bit of a downturn in consumer spend, if you have a 50% drop in car sales, as some manufacturers have seen, you have a 50% drop in revenue. In our instance, we're being paid for every car we've made for the last 15 years. Do you think what a difference that would make to the existing industry if they were in that position now?
Certainly would change that whole stream of the economics and the impact on society. But Hugo, say some more in terms of this, the integration across streams. You started to allude to it. It seems to me that's an important element here.
Yes, we've essentially got seven core strategies that are all designed as a whole system. They're all complementary and mutually reinforcing and shouldn't be judged on their own. Many of them don't make a great deal of economic or performance sense on their own, but as a system, we think they're highly superior. One is the technology we've discussed. The second is the sale of service we've discussed. The third is that we're taking this sale of service model upstream into the supply chain. And at the moment, the relationship between the supply chain and auto manufacturers is not good. But essentially, suppliers have and manufacturers have opposing interests again. If you sell components to a manufacturer, you want to sell at as high a price as possible with as short a life as possible so you can sell another one. And that's hardly likely to lead to a collaborative relationship. In our case, we're leasing the components off the supply chain. And that means that we have a shared interest in the longevity of the components. The fourth is the infrastructure question. People often talk about the chicken and egg of who's going to build hydrogen cars until there's the infrastructure and vice versa. In our case, we're designing vehicles for local use. It can cruise at 50 miles an hour. It can reach 50 miles an hour in 9 seconds. And it's a very nippy, fun car to drive. But it's not designed for intercity use. The point about that is that if you build a car that can drive long distance on motorways at motorway speeds, you really don't have a market until you've got a nationwide network of refueling infrastructure. And that is a colossal gamble, even for national governments. In our case, if you go to small cities of small to medium cities, up to 300,000 people, we can put a single refueling station in the city. We've got a range of 240 miles. That's more than a week's use for a car like this. And that means going through the city centre once a week is entirely practical. The point about that is that you've got a commercial market in a 25-mile radius around that refueling point. And the increment by which you grow your market is one refueling station rather than 1,000 refueling stations.
Mm-hmm.
It means you can then offer a turnkey template package of refueling station and 50 vehicles to other cities, and you can incrementally grow a nationwide network without ever taking a nationwide gamble on the infrastructure. The fifth is the manufacturing strategy. With composite materials, we believe the optimal scale of a plant will make about 5,000 vehicles per annum and employ about 200 people. And when you want more volume produced, you just have more of these plants at that scale. You never have to write off a small plant and build a bigger one. And the sixth strategy is that we are open sourcing all the technology. There's an independent foundation that we've set up that will host all the intellectual property and the designs of the cars. Anybody can use it, use these designs, and make cars in competition to us. And we believe that that is commercially in our interest. We're pioneering very different standards. We think they're much better. But however much better they are, if we try and hang on to these standards ourselves and capture all the benefit, we will lose. I mean, the classic analogy is Sony losing over Betamax tapes. And if Sony lost a standards war, then we certainly will. So
yes,
we want as many people as possible to copy. And that allows us to build a world in which the components are not mark-specific to our cars. They're generic components like fuel cells and electric motors, which allows us to collaborate with our competitors to build volume in the supply chain because we all want the same components. It also means that we don't need to develop our own distribution channels because they will be supporting all cars using this technology.
So, Hugo, on that, I hear the music in the background. I don't want to interrupt you, but I don't want to lose the train of thought. And I know the progression of this comes together in an integrated way that is so compelling. But let's take a break because I want to optimize our time in the back end here in the last segment here and pull this together about the different threads, the different strategies. I think we have one more here. But coming back in a moment, because we're also, folks, going to talk about the link to the community, as Hugo has described, the infrastructure, the capacity, capacity, the size of the manufacturing, huge potential here. Come back here for the last segment in a moment. Thanks.
Up-to-date business and financial news. Call now and get the financial information you need. 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790.
The experts are here.
Voice America Business Network. The world is in flux, primed for a great transition, possibly an epical one. How does it impact you? Does it reshape the questions you ask? The way you view leadership. Today's complexities and challenges call for new realms of leadership. The world needs resilience and adaptability, new levels of innovation and brilliance. At Avastone Consulting, we know that our times call for shifts of mind. How do we cultivate real shifts of mind in our leaders? Not through conventional development, which focuses on gaining skills and knowledge within an established worldview. Shifts of mind truly expand the worldview itself, enlarge the capacity to see through new eyes, and transform interpretations of reality and the actions that accompany them. Those who embrace shifts of mind are the kind of leaders that Avastone helps to build. Change the way you pursue the future. Call Avastone Consulting at 1-678-461-8888. That's 1-678-461-8880. Or visit avastoneconsulting.com. Avastone Consulting, your source for leadership development, working with complex organizations toward evolutionary shifts of mind.
The Marsh Engel Show. Join the movement to empower yourself with the essentials of feminine power and success, and learn how women around the world are becoming more inspired, more influential, and absolutely amazing. Each week, Marsh sits down for an engaging conversation with women who are boldly committed to living their most amazing life. You'll discover ways to step into your greatest vision, deepen your relationships, and unleash your real creative brilliance. Get ready. It's time to jump into the conversation. That's Monday afternoons at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern for the Marsh Engel Show on the Voice America Business Network.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, we're back. Last segment with Hugo here. New car, new business model, new view of breakthrough possibilities. And I think from the last segment, you're beginning to see how this all comes together and the potential, the power of that potential, and especially when you start to point to the infrastructure. One unit for a town like where I'm living here could support where we are and what's going on. Hugo, I don't want to cut it short, though, because I think we were in the midst of conversation about seven streams. You were in open source, and we had one other to go. Let's pick up that before we really even talk more about community and some of the the examples and where we can go with it.
Yes, sure. Well, the last element is the shared ownership model that we've developed, and the company is actually a limited liability partnership, and it's owned instead of by shareholders, it's owned by six custodian bodies. These bodies represent the interests of six stakeholder groups that we've identified, all of whom have a tangible impact on the success of the business. The fiduciary responsibility of the board of the company is to balance and protect the benefit streams that these stakeholders seek. At the moment, most businesses are single stakeholder organizations with a fiduciary responsibility to maximize the interests of one stakeholder, generally the shareholder. If that is the case, all other interests are by definition subordinated to the interests of shareholders, and so you can hardly expect to garner the great goodwill of those other five stakeholder bodies. In our case, all those benefit streams are balanced and protected, and we therefore believe that we will have a much greater level of goodwill from these six stakeholder groups than any corporation has ever normally been able to achieve. And we also do not believe that it's a zero-sum system. Just because other parties are doing better, it doesn't mean that investors will do worse. Quite the contrary, in fact, because we have such a level of goodwill engaged amongst all relevant communities, we believe it'll be a more successful and, above all, a more resilient company. So investors will actually do better by virtue of participating in this model. And the paradox, I suppose, is that to achieve this better return, they have to resign control. But no partnership can ever really thrive if one partner dominates. I should perhaps specify the six bodies are representing the investors, the environment, the staff of the business, the users of the cars, the commercial partners, that is, suppliers and also infrastructure providers, and what we call neighbors, who are all those bodies who have no direct commercial relationship with the company, so local government who are interested in employment, bodies interested in road safety and air quality, things like that. And all those bodies have absolutely equal rights in voicing governance, their interest in the governance of the business. The differences between all those stakeholders is recognized through contracts that each stakeholder holds with the business. You'd expect employees and suppliers, for instance, to have a contract with the business, but in our case, the investors have a contract. They hold what is a note that, in all to all intents and purposes, looks like an equity note, except it carries no direct voting rights. Those voting rights are exercised through the custodian body, whereas the contract for investment and return, financial return, is held directly with the limited liability partnership. Does that slightly?
So it seems like it's easy. It seems like you've got the ability to give up control, because what I'm hearing is an optimal combination of collaboration and competition. You're doing something very different in this that just shatters the paradigm of it and allows a new field of integration and inquiry together and engagement together here, Hugo.
Absolutely. We believe it, furthermore, will produce a better quality of decision and much longer time horizons dominating that decision-making process.
And, so Hugo, how would this work? I live in a local community here. Our listeners know it. It's smaller in terms of its orientation, sustainability focus, Sarasota, Florida. We're talking about a size that would be appropriate for the scale of the infrastructure involved. How does a community engage in this, and how does that fit into the structure?
Well, we have, at the moment, the neighbors body is represented by somebody who is a councillor for a local council. At the moment, the business is a relatively small business, so we don't have a large number of people. We want to remain a very streamlined body, but the representative of the neighbors group and, for instance, the environment group are truly independent people who have absolutely, there is no ability for us to exercise pressure on them to twist their view one way or another. The environment, for instance, the representative, what I should add, as well as having a demonstrable interest in the success of the business, it's also important that in identifying these benefit streams and the people who seek them, that people have something at risk. The environment is represented by somebody who's very well known in the environmental movement in the UK called Peter Lang. And Peter is somebody who doesn't earn a great deal of money. What his biggest asset in life is his integrity and his reputation in the environmental field. And he's never been near a car company. So it's a big risk for him. And if investors think they've got something at risk, I can assure them that Peter Lang has every bit as much at risk as well.
Yes. And so, Hugo, can you say something about where this is getting any beachheads? I know this is the early waves of this evolution and getting this into the world, but can you describe a little bit about what's happening where?
Well, in terms of how this is coming together and the people who are getting involved and why they're getting involved?
I mean, anything like about that that gives a sense, a tangible sense for folks about the community where people are engaged.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think, I mean, I've mentioned the investors. I've mentioned the Neighbours representative who's speaking from the position of local council and the environment person. The investors, I think I must point out, they are also deeply involved in the development of this governance system. We've got one principal investor who's been with us for 4 years, our first investors, who are a branch of the Porsche family. It's somebody called Ernst Piech and his son Sebastian. And Ernst's younger brother is the chairman of VW. But they have got it, and they are brought up in German heavy industrial world. But they believe absolutely that having this multiple strands of partners will lead to a much more successful business. And they are at one with the concept. It certainly takes an enlightened investor, but they are out there.
Well, I hear that. It takes that enlightened sense, and I'm hearing the music building in the background. I think this conversation has so much more legs to it. We're going to have to continue, I hope, at a part two of this. But, Hugo, a great introduction today, and kudos to you and all of those that are with you in really helping serve and nurture and bring this kind of a breakthrough view. Thank you so much, Hugo, for joining us today.
Thank you very much, John. My pleasure.
Good. We look forward to part two on this, Hugo. So, and listeners, you're getting a sense here. More of Zoomed about breakthroughs. This, to me, and you can hear through Hugo's description, really epitomizes the Zoomed conversation about the whole view, about tangible reality. How do we actually support the change, the extraordinary shifts coming, the nature of the world that is shifting, and how do we underpin it with our own movement in concert? That's our conversation here on Zoomed. Again, Hugo, wonderful to have you here. Wonderful to see the work. Until next week, folks, enjoy, and this conversation continues. Thanks. Have a good week.
Thank you again for listening to Zoomed Leadership with host John Schmidt. Please be sure to join us again next Monday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. And have a terrific week.